everybody. Welcome to the Tangerine Dream Team. The expanded hour starts now. Tuesday, 6 to 8. I'm Coral Reef. I'm going to be playing music, and we're going to have two guests on the studio. One in the studio, one on phone later. So we'll get down to some music. It's going to be some... You'll find out. Just talking about local things that happen to people, and we're talking about people that have gone places and describing their experiences through psychedelic world in the second hour coming up. So enjoy while you can, and you're listening to freakradio.org 101.1 FM.
I approach you without my shields. Isn't it amazing?
That was by Morrow. Now some from Christian Raphael.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, heading for a train. Feeling nearly faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained. Took us all the way to New Orleans. Well, I pulled my harp out of my dirty red bandana and I played it soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wiper slapping time and Bobby clapping hands. I sang up every song that drive I knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. For me and my Bobby McGee. From the coal mines of Kentucky to the California sun, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. She stuck beside me through all my thick and thin. And every night she kept me from the cold. And somewhere near Salinas, I let her slip away. She was looking for that home, and I hope she'll find it. Trade all my tomorrows for a single yesterday. Holding Bobby's body next to mine. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby McGee. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing but it's free. Feeling good was easy when Bobby sang the blues. And feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby McGee. Good enough for me and my Bobby McGee. good enough for me and my Bobby McGee. Bobby McGee.
And I'd like to welcome the first guest who's here in the studio. Hi, Robert. This is Robert Facer.
How you doing, Coral?
I'm doing great. Glad that you're here again. We had Robert last week, and there was not enough time to go through all his quests that I wanted, and I wanted to ask him about the latest things gone on with his ticket. Robert is a person who you wanted to tell where you came from and when. First, I could tell the audience he didn't come through ordinary means of transportation. So how did you get here, Robert?
Well, you'd have to go quite a ways back, but 20 years ago, I started paddling a kayak out of Valdez, Alaska, and it took me until 2008 to make it to Santa Cruz.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was a long trip. I'd go about 250 miles a year, and I made a slight side journey up the Columbia River for 3 years, so it put an extra 1,000 miles on my journey. But I've gone quite a ways in a kayak.
Is it the same kayak that you started with 20 years ago?
No, I started with a Rotiform plastic white water boat, and that got me the first 128 miles. And then the waters I was getting into were so severe that I bought a 17-foot Sita Viking. Sita is a company that makes or was manufacturing kayaks out of Chula Vista, California, but they had a kayak shop in Cordova, and I bought that boat, and it took me 900 miles in a period of actually 3 years down to Ketchikan, where I got another boat, and that made it in another, gosh darn, let me think, how long? It took another 4 years, I guess, but I made it down to the Columbia River, and there I lost that boat in the surf and built one out of quarter-inch marine plywood and took it up the Columbia River to the as far as the Canadian border. I went up to Okanagan and then came back down, and someone stole that. That was, I believe, in the year 2000. And then I built another boat and got that as far as Nehalem and built another boat. I gave that boat to a friend, and the one that I built in Nehalem, I got it as far as Newport, Oregon, and I lost it in the surf in 2002. And then I decided that the waters were getting kind of rough, so I actually hiked all the way from, Nehalem, or Newport, and then I hiked down to Arcata, and then I hiked as far as Santa Rosa, where I built the boat that I've got now, in the middle of the freeway at Santa Rosa Creek, and took it down the creek to the ocean. And finally got it to here. It took me 4 years to get to Santa Cruz from Santa Rosa, which is a distance of about 200 miles.
So you built a new boat there from getting the lumber from the people there from Santa Rosa? Or?
I didn't build it. I didn't put any lumber in that boat. I built the entire boat out of any. I was very careful to not put any not incorporate anything into the structure of the boat that had ever been basically murdered in the woods.
So what? Oh, that's what you did. So what exactly is that? What did you not use? You didn't use anything that grew in the woods. And what did you use?
Excuse me.
Let me ask the straight way.
Well, anything that, like a logging company, especially when I was in Arcata, I got really familiar with this. A logging company will come into a to an area and start hanging up orange flags. Mm-hmm. And then they come in one day and start up their chainsaws and just take paradise, basically, and destroy it. They leave a big field of stumps. So any wood that went through this particular process is you can build things with it, but anything that's totally unsinkable, like the Indian boats, the ones that Indian, not Hindu type, but you know, American Native American Indian tribes up in Washington and Oregon, they carve boats. And they're basically unsinkable. They're maybe 2, 3, 4 inches thick, and they're solid wood, and they just carve out a big groove down the middle of it and then, you know, make it more or less shape streamlined around the outside, and there's no way to sink them at all. You can turn them upside down, you can fill them up with water, but you can't sink them. And the trees that they make these out of are all windfalls or things that, you know, washed down the river and landed there or something like that. But they, as far as I know, they never make them. There would be no reason to make them because there aren't that many of them. But they make them out of windfalls, or they, you know, things that have died, you know, fallen by a natural method, not come in and murdered by a bunch of insane, if you'll excuse I won't say insane, God is everywhere, and he permits it, so you know it can't be totally insane. But on the other hand, I consider logging to be just a pretty self-defeating occupation.
Yeah, you said that right. I mean, you said that. I think that not the way you wanted to say it originally. You don't use any kind of lumber then?
Not in the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my guitar, I got no idea where they got that wood, you know, and I use that all the time. And anything else, you know, that's made out of wood, I use a lot of implements and so forth. But as far as the thing that's eventually would end up on the bottom of the ocean if you ever sank it, that's mm-hmm. not going to be anything that was ever cut down in that fashion.
So where's your boat right now?
Parked over at the harbor.
All right.
Yeah, it's all fiberglass and PVC and foam and every kind of thing. It basically an unsinkable boat.
And how do you make sure it stays there besides tying it?
Oh, I'm paying rent there.
Oh. Oh, cool. So you pay, not a slip. You mean to tie it off. All right.
Yeah, they're giving me a special deal because usually they haul them out of the water in the winter, but they just let me park it at the dock.
Oh. Now, one time you wanted to make sure it was there, and you sat on the beach and watched for a while. What happened?
Oh.
Or a few times.
Well, it's a long story. Santa Cruz is not most of the power. The people that are in power in Santa Cruz did not arrive here by kayak. At the very least, they came by covered wagon across the mountains, and most of them probably drove in on a paved road with their own automobile and just a whole bunch of money. You know, and this is how they got to Santa Cruz, and this is their whole outlook, is that everybody gets here by the road, and you know, there's no thought at all of anyone that would come into Santa Cruz by the water. So the place is hostile to this type of approach, not deliberately, but if you come cruising into Santa Cruz in a kayak from San Francisco Bay, and the first thing that you're going to find out is you can't land on the beach. They won't let you land on a beach. If you park at the harbor, they'll let you go for a while, but eventually they'll come up and say, hey, you know, we want $20 a night to park at the dock. So that takes care of two possibilities. You can park the boat off the beach, which is what I eventually did, but then you have a problem with people coming around and vandalizing it, and there's not much you can do because it's 100 yards out in the water. So, you know, it's just a matter of what they need is a visitor's dock, like they've got in San Francisco Bay at a couple of different spots where you can pull in, park your dinghy or your kayak or something like that for a couple of days, and then, you know, to be able to stay on the land for 72 hours after you've been for a long time, like weeks or months out in the water, is it's not just a blessing, it's a necessity. You have to be able to operate off of the land. Man is not a fish. He can't live out in the water. He can stay out there for a while, but if he wants to acquire anything to eat, he's got to have both feet on the ground. You can go out there, you know, you can, like, they go out and they catch fish, you know, and they say, well, you know, we could live out there in the water forever and just eat fish. But this isn't actually the case. In order to acquire everything, most of your time has to be on the ground. This is not a guess. This is an absolute necessity. If you don't have your boat basically parked on the beach, there's really no way that you can supply it. I found this to be true. I mean, you know, I've had my boat, you know, for a long time, out in the water, and it's not acquiring it. You know, like when I was in San Francisco Bay, for instance, you know, I could land it. I'd be able to get, this and that, and,
are you ready?
Be able to, you know, supply it and get water for it and so forth like that. You can't do that unless you can get the boat in a very, very secure position.
No, would you like to be?
Hi.
You're on the phone.
Hi, you got a hold of a minute. I took a call and the person would like to be in the air. Just a second. Okay, go ahead.
Well, my question is, I assume you're an American citizen and you've traveled along the coast. Isn't there a constitutional right, freedom to travel? Is there a basis in court to allow people like you to freely travel based on a constitutional right?
Well, yeah, you can travel. Anybody can in America. I mean, there's no law against traveling. And in Canada, when I was there, they kind of messed you up a little bit because they make it difficult to get your mail sent to a different post office, which kind of interferes a little bit with your freedom to travel. But there's no problem like that in America.
Oh, there isn't? Okay, because when you mentioned when you seek to dock in Santa Cruz, you can't go on the beach, and then they charge you $20 to go to the public dock.
Yep.
Isn't that impeding upon your freedom to travel?
I'm sure it is.
Okay, that's my only question. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, caller.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was interesting. So what has, where else have you tried to dock, Robert? Well, you told me Santa Rosa.
Well, I can't. No, I came
couldn't
down.
Have gone there.
I came down from Valdez. I'll enumerate them. I spent the winter in Cordova. I spent the winter in Yakutat. Spent the winter in Sitka. Spent the winter in Ketchikan, and then I hit and then I hit Canada. Well, Canada is like in the first place. If you've got any kind of marijuana, anything on your record, like, you know, a lot of people do from way, way back when they were young and, you know, didn't know, you know, good from evil, you know, they might have some marijuana busts. Well, if you do, you can't ever get into Canada. They won't even let you in. So, you know, the whole time, you know, it was a 600-mile trip. Normally, I would travel 250 miles in a year's time, stop, and at that point, I would be as familiar with the area enough so that I could survive the winter, because it wasn't that much different from 250 miles back. But 600 miles is a considerably greater distance, and traveling that far in 1 year kind of threw me off a little bit. It was almost like an environmental I couldn't adapt. I couldn't understand. There were things about the area that I eventually got to, and it took me like two or three months, I guess, to travel all the way from Ketchikan to Bellingham, Washington. And there were things about the area when I arrived that I couldn't adapt to as well as I could have if I had stayed in Canada. So I think that it would be a lot easier to survive if you didn't have to travel that far. But what was your question again?
You answered it. You told us where you have been and what kind of travails you've made. And you started out from 20 years ago from
Valdez. That's how far I've come without using petroleum.
My God. So what kind of stories about petroleum you want to talk about? You told me one.
Petroleum? Oh,
no.
Okay, here's Alaska. You know, I got there in 1974. They were building a pipeline, but they hadn't actually done any pumping out yet. All I can say about it at that point was it was the wildest party that I have ever seen. I mean, it was constant, you know, music and people generally, God forbid, mostly drunk on beer, wine, hard liquor. It was an alcoholic's paradise is what it actually was. And then they opened the pipeline in 1977 and the police moved in. Before then, you know, you never even hardly saw the police. You know, they were, you know, a factor which only came out when they were called, and you know, it was an actual necessity. Suddenly, they started interfering with people having fun, and at that point, you know, the place, you know, just automatically started to quiet down. And by the time I left in 1989. You could hardly even raise your voice in the place, you know, without, you know, having a cop come down on you. I mean, it was that patrolled. So I'm personally of the opinion that petroleum is fine in the ground, and but as far as, you know, the problem arises when you start burning it, and I'm not sure if it's because of the actual fact that you're burning this stuff up that's causing it to be more a negative situation, or whether it's the fact that there's suddenly a very, very hot fire. I strongly suspect it has a lot to do with the very, very hot fire part. I mean, you know, all of a sudden, you know, if a million people start burning gasoline, there's going to be enough heat coming out of their exhaust pipes to basically warm up the atmosphere. Somebody said, described it to me as you take your bathtub and stir it up a little bit, and then affect the water with your normal household blowtorch, I believe was the term mm-hmm. that he used, and see what happens to it. You know, I mean, basically, you know, that's what's happened to the earth. This global warming thing is just nothing but a great big huge fire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're on fire, I know. A lot of other shows about that. We could talk about that more, but what's on your mind these days? Anything happened to you with Santa Cruz as far as, like, being able to live here and do what you want, or has there been any problem? You know, have you gotten any camping tickets, for example?
Oh, I've been okay. I tried to pull my boat up into the river one day, and I got a ticket for having my boat up in San Lorenzo River. I thought that the ranger was a little bit incorrect. He gave me 24 hours to pull the boat out, otherwise he was going to impound it. But he didn't check to see what the surf was like. And I darn near lost the boat at the mouth of the river trying to get it out. So next time, I do hope Ranger Wallace, before he tells you you got to take your boat straight out of the river, that he checks to see the size of the surf. I think that was a little bit abrupt of him. I'm not going to say that he did it on purpose. He probably has never actually paddled in a kayak, so he wouldn't know the difference, you know, between big surf or little surf. But that is a factor. You could kill somebody that way.
No, well, that's very important to hear. You know, he just don't want to be known as a killer of innocent people. I'm sure. You're listening to Free Radio, freakradio.org, Tangerine Dream Team, first hour. I'm here with Robert Facer, and we're talking about experiences he's had coming in on a kayak living here in Santa Cruz the last 2 years, is it?
Pretty near, 21 months.
And he's a person that lives outside, and he's had to deal with a lot of people not liking that fact, I mean, somewhat. Or other things that come up. What's happening as far as the court with you?
I got a couple of camping tickets. We're trying to. I'm basically, there's a large number of people that don't like the camping ordinance that exists in Santa Cruz County. Today I placed this particular proposal, which I'll read to you right now, before the city council. Upon purchasing, this is the proposal that I was making to try to undo the revised the camping ordinances. It just says you can't. Basically, it says if you ain't paying rent to somebody, then get out of Santa Cruz. Is what the law actually is in its entirety. This is what the law says, and the only reason that this has never been challenged in the court is because the people that it victimizes are generally too poor to do anything about it. I'm concerned. Well, not concerned, but I'm absolutely positive that eventually they're going to try to inflict this law upon somebody with a little bit of money, and they're going to end up owing them quite a bit because the law is obviously unconstitutional. Here is the proposal that I am making to the city council at this point. Upon purchasing a permit for a reasonable amount from the Department of Fish and Game, and I thought, you know, $5 would be a reasonable amount, but I'm sure that the city council would have its own opinion there. Persons are allowed to set up a camp, which includes a flexible, movable dwelling for a period of 7 days in one location. At the end of 7 days, the entire camp must be moved as near as possible to 100 yards or more. The site vacated must be free of litter. More than 3 pieces of visible trash of more than 1 ounce would constitute a violation. At the end of 7 days, the permit must also be renewed at no cost if the party wishes to remain, and failure to renew the permit at the end of 7 days would mean that the permit would be revoked and could not be acquired again for a period of 6 months. Persons setting up a visible camp without a permit, one which includes a roof, would be guilty of a violation. I think basically the problem in Santa Cruz is people that come to this city and they stay a little while, and then, but hitchhiking is so much fun. They're new at it. They probably just got out of the relative bondage of school and parentage and so forth, and so here they sit in Santa Cruz, and then they decide to hitchhike 1,000 miles, so they go way far away, and then they come back to Santa Cruz again, and with no thought at all to the fact that the intervening distance might have cost them anything, because they've never really done that much traveling. So I think that making them giving them this incentive to stay, and also to stay away for a long enough period of time so that they're not putting too much of a strain on the system, would be I think it would help Santa Cruz. This is my
That was what you suggestion. Read in the 2 minute oral communication part.
Yes.
Or was it on a no? Was it an agenda item?
Yeah, I read it. I wasn't on the agenda. I passed out copies of this to the entire city council, and I also read it in 2 minutes. But actually, today they weren't so many people on the oral communications, so they gave us all 3 minutes.
Well, I gotta just hand it to them. They have a lot of time to give.
Yeah.
I mean, they guess that was another whole minute. Okay. And so how many people do you think were there?
Oh, I don't know. Gosh, there was probably 20 or 30 people in the audience, or maybe somewhere around there, probably not more than 20, I think. People come and go, you know, they make their proposal or they make their statement or they get their whatever it is passed or
yeah.
so forth, and then they take off out the door, so...
At least you got to be on community TV also, well, you know, when they get everybody that's up at the microphone.
Oh.
You're on.
Well, I'm not supposed to give my permission to have my picture taken, so I...
oh, dear.
I pretend to ignore that.
Now, why is that? You want to talk about that?
Well, the Bible says you're not supposed to make any type of graven image. My religion, which is Amish... We say if someone asks you if they can take your picture, just tell them, well, my religion doesn't allow me to have my picture taken. But if they, you know, if they're contentious or so forth, you don't fight it. You just, you know, let them go ahead and take their picture. But you know, if they do ask you, you say, well, no, I'm not supposed to give my permission to have my picture taken.
Uh huh. And so you accidentally went out over the video waves there.
Oh, that's okay, I guess. I mean, I imagine it makes a great deal of difference. You know, if you're talking on TV, if there's a lot of people watching, they're probably you're being judged. I mean, they can look at you and they can say, well, okay, you know, this guy's a swindler, or this guy, you know, he's honest, or, you know, this guy knows something, or this guy is stupid. When you get on TV, I think the important factor is that you've got to be correct, mathematically correct.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you're not preaching anything that would cause those who were following you in some way to make a mistake. In other words, like if I went on TV for money, or if I went on TV for any reason other than the fact that, you know, it just happens that I'm trying to talk to the city council and they just happen to be filming everybody that's talking to the city council. If there was any other reason for that, I would be in a way leading people astray, because here I am telling them that it's okay to be on TV, which uh-huh. we don't believe it is.
Yeah. Well, the city council always tapes people. They always they always bring community television down there. And I guess you could ask them that they turn it off while you're, maybe just have a sound on. I don't know. They've done that other times. They say turn off the camera when they don't want certain things shown.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you walk into the drugstore, you're on TV. You know, I mean,
yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, the fact that it's being broadcast to a lot of people, I don't know that. I mean, you tell me that's true, and I imagine that it's probably true, but I still don't know that.
Right. Like now, how many people out there are listening? So how do we get people to call in and let us know? Well, also, you can be online and we can tell how many people are streaming this show. I don't know how to tell, but there is a way to tell how many people are listening through via the internet. So you're tuned in to 101.1 FM, and you could also be streaming at freakradio.org, 101.1 FM Santa Cruz, the Tangerine Dream Team Hour. I'm almost wrapping it up with Robert, and I'd like him, if he'd like to, because of the next guest coming on, he'd like to stay and maybe talk to him. Our next guest will be Paul Lee, who has an acquaintance with Robert here. And so I would invite you to stay if you want to see how that conversation goes.
All
next
right.
Hour.
I'll do that.
Now, as for this last, what I'm interested in was the ordinance about singing or noise and unreasonable noise that's been in the forefront for four performers out on the Pacific Avenue, which happened to be one of them was yourself. Oh. You got in the middle of something that happened on January 6th.
Oh, all four of us. We were doing nothing. Somebody just didn't like us. The last time I was on your show, I believe a week or two ago, I said, you know, well, somehow we stepped into somebody's personal feud. I've played drums, I've played guitar, I've played considerably louder and for a considerably longer time, and nobody has ever said a darn thing to me. And all we were doing there was playing very softly and, playing music that was it wasn't anything really that we weren't. It was a political statement that we were making. It wasn't. We weren't playing in order to create a musical atmosphere. We were basically making a political statement, and they came along and hit us with this unreasonable noise clause, which is basically unconstitutional for a couple of reasons. In the first place, it says that Congress shall make no law respecting the citizens' right to freely assemble. If a musician is playing on the street, there can be no other thing that will happen. I mean, basically, a musician is the seed of an assembly. If he's sitting there and if he's any good, then there is an assembly. Everybody, you know, people are going to go by, they're going to stop and listen. You know, okay, so there's an assembly. And so affecting a musician's right to play is affecting the law which says that affecting the citizen's right to freely assemble. So you've got a constitutional case here. The fact that it hasn't ever been taken to very, very high in the courts.
An appellate level.
Yeah, it's probably because they just, the people that they've given tickets to have not had the money or the time, you know, because like the, to make a place unlivable is a good way to get rid of people now at this point, because it's easy to hitchhike. I understand. I have never done it, but I understand that, you know, it's not too hard to get out on the highway and get a ride to San Francisco or to Berkeley or to someplace, you know, say L.A. or wherever you decide to go. Most people aren't going to fight it for this reason, and for that reason, I believe is why they figured they were able to make this law, was because the people that they were going to challenge with it weren't going to be the kind of people that were going to take them to court. But like I said before, if they ever do hit anybody with any money, they're probably in for a problem.
We've been talking with Robert Facer, and I'm glad he came, and I'm inviting him to hang around. So we're going to play a few tunes right now, and our next guest will be coming in shortly.
Things I forgot, but I'll never forget. First time I saw you, last time we met, when you bid me farewell, somehow I knew you were an angel just passing through, just passing through here, just passing on through, heading for somewhere I wish I knew.
live a life that's true. You were an angel just passing through. And I remember when you told me, if you dream just a little bit, you'll only live just a little bit. And I ain't gonna live just a little bit. And if you give just a little bit, you'll only get but a little bit. But if you give it all you got, give it your very best shot, then when you've taken your last breath, you can really say, no regrets, no regrets. Well, I saw you last night, and you whispered my name. 10,000 voices falling like rain, and you were smiling just like you used to do. You were an angel just passing through, just passing through here, just passing on through. Like many before you and after will too, 'cause our life's blood is passion and our days here but few. We are all angels just passing through. We are all angels just passing through. Just passing through.
Christian Raphael, One More by Christian. I hope you've enjoyed the first hour. Tangerine Dream Team.
Where I belong.
Welcome to the second hour of Tangerine Dream Team. Coral Reef here. I'm going to be introducing my friend who's going to be interviewing Polly.
Attend,
myself.
You gallant Irishmen, and listen for a while. I'll sing to you the praises of the sons of Erin's Isle. It's of those gallant heroes who voluntarily ran to release two Irish shamrocks from an English prison van. The 18th of September, it was in that dreadful year, when sorrow and excitement ran throughout all Lancashire. At a gathering of the Irish boys, they volunteered each man to release those Irish prisoners out of the prison van. Hurrah, my lads, for freedom, let's all join heart and hand. May the Lord have mercy on the boys that helped to smash the van. In Manchester one morning those good heroes did agree their leaders Kelly and Deasy should have their liberty. They drank a health to Ireland and soon made up a plan to meet the prisoners on the road and take and smash the van. Hurrah, my lads, for freedom, let's all join heart and hand. May the Lord have mercy on the boys that helped to smash the van. With courage bold those heroes went and soon the van did stop. They cleared the guards from back and front and then smashed in the top. But in blowing open off the lot they chanced to kill a man. So three men must die on the scaffold high for smashing of the van. Hurrah, my lads, for freedom, let's all join heart and hand. May the Lord have mercy on the boys that helped to smash the van. So now, kind friends, I will conclude, I think it would be right that all true-hearted Irishmen together should unite. Together should sympathise, my friends, and do the best we can to keep the memories evergreen of the boys that smashed the van. Hurrah, my lads, for freedom, let's all join heart and hand. May the Lord have mercy on the boys that helped to smash the van.
I went over to Willits, California, a number of years ago. I went to visit a powerful, powerful woman who became a great friend, a lady named Judy Berry. Remember Judy Berry? She's worked for Earth First, founder of Earth First IWW Local Number One. She's a strong union woman and a strong environmental activist. She started the Redwood Summer, which was working on sort of physically surround the old growth redwoods and try to give the Forest for All initiative a chance to catch up. Of course, that failed. While we were having a meeting there in Willits with a bunch of Jibba loggers establishing peacekeeping agreements, I thought I was there to work on the nonviolence. Somebody stuck a bomb in her car under the seat. Well, the next morning, Judy Berry and I had gone down to Berkeley in that car. I wanted to talk about the nonviolent program and get her ideas about it, and also be going to swap songs and the songs she wanted to learn from me and songs I wanted to learn from her. Well, that bomb didn't go off. We got to see the peace meeting. They were doing food for Redwood Summer in Berkeley. Next morning, I got up and came home, and Judy Berry and Darryl Turney got in the car and drove off to Santa Cruz. The car exploded, wounded her grievously. She recovered. She survived painfully. And went back to organizing, and went back to playing the fiddle, and she laughed more than anybody I ever met in my life in the face of the direst of circumstances. On that trip down, talking about the nonviolence, Judy Berry said, "The man, and I mean the man, can escalate the violence from a cop on the beat with a handgun all the way up to a hydrogen bomb and everything in between." And he's always saying, come up that road of armed struggle, because I own that road, come up that road, and it'll kill you. If you don't use that road, he said, you got to take a road he doesn't know, take a road he doesn't own, a road he doesn't know anything about, that road of nonviolence, nonviolent direct action. He said, come up that road, he said. And nonviolence is not a tactic, it's not a strategy, it is a way of life. It is a practical necessity. Well, I have learned this song from the great Frankie Armstrong, by a friend of mine named Leon Rosterson. And then I taught it to a woman driver. About Gerard Wynne Stanley, a preacher in the 1600s. All most of his speeches were destroyed, his sermons, but what was left, the monsters were gathered together and made into this Baptist song. In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged bandit called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the lands in common and to make the wastelands roll. This earth divided, we shall make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. The sin of poverty we do disdain. No one has any right to buy or sell the earth for private gain. By death and murder, they took the land. Now everywhere the walls spring up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. Their clergy castle us with heaven and they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor folks starve. We live, we work together, we need no swords. We will not bow unto the masters, nor pay rents unto the lords. We are free people, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property the order came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. They came in peace, the order came to cut them down. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy or sell the earth for private gain. This earth divided, we shall make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all.
Train in a station. with plasticine pores, with looking glass time. Someday someone is there at the turnstile, the girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
On the line now with us is Paul Lee. How are you doing, Paul? There. Okay. Got it. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I'm on the line. I'm on the line. I'm over the line.
Ready?
What does it mean? Did you cut me out?
Free radio, and we've got Paul Lee on the line. We just want to be able to hear her. Well, tried it on. I can hear myself now, but Paul.
Hello, can you hear me?
Now I can hear you.
You can hear me.
Loud and clear.
I'm not only on the line, I'm over the line.
Well, I'd like to have you talk about that.
Really?
You're calling, and we're glad you are. We're calling you. And my friend, partner here, Freedom, would like to introduce you. And why don't you go to your mic?
Well, it's not working right now. I'll use this one. Paul Lee is a local resident. He's been active in herbalism and studied divinity at Harvard. A religious man. He's done a lot of good work with the homeless here. He's actually helping with the appeal of our earlier guest. And he was also a member of the Psychedelics Club at Harvard back in the 60s. And that's what we'd like to talk to him about tonight. How did you get involved in the Psychedelics Club at Harvard?
Well, Leary wanted to shift the model from psychotomimetic, where the psychedelic drugs induced a psychotic experience. They were actually used as training materials for psychiatrists. He wanted to shift it from psychotomimetic to mysticomimetic because he had a real strong notion that it induced a religious experience that could be life-transforming. And so I was at Harvard Divinity School. I had been a teaching assistant to Paul Tillich, the most renowned theologian in the country, if not the world. And so I was invited to take part in the psychedelic experience with Leary at Houston Smith's house. And then I got involved with the group.
I see. So, and that's when that was your first experience with psychedelics?
Yes. Could you tell
us about the first time you got high.
Well, it was at Houston Smith's house. We were given LSD. And it was, I could only think of a metaphor of the bomb. It was an internalized bomb. It exploded your consciousness. You were flooded with these sensations. You went out on a phantasmagoria experience, came back again, went out again, came back again, went out again. They all kind of got confused. And this went on for 8 hours. So it was one of the most breathtaking trips that I could ever imagine.
Yes, almost revolutionary. In fact, Leary was thinking that he would revolutionize society with these new substances, and that's kind of what happened with the 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It exploded all over the country. There was an interesting problem at the time where Alan Watts and I think even Aldous Huxley cautioned Tim about taking it public. They had a sense that it should be kept private. The initiation was really something that should be done in private. And Tim was an Irish revolutionary, and he didn't agree and thought that everybody ought to be able to partake of such substances and get a sense of the furthest reaches of consciousness beyond one's wildest dreams.
That's interesting. Well, we're all revolutionaries here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I personally believe that LSD could be a viable alternative to regular warfare. I'd like to ask you about Aldous Huxley again. I heard that when he died, that was his actual first LSD trip, wasn't it?
No, that is first. He requested that he be given LSD at the point of death, and his wife gave it to him, and he died high.
Ironically, that was the same day as the Kennedy assassination.
That's right.
That was very interesting. I heard your talk the other night you gave on this.
You know, and it segued back to the fact that Timothy Leary met Aldous on the day that Kennedy was elected president.
It's the synchronicities of it.
Yeah, isn't that, that's really strange.
There is a mystical side to LSD. Did it provide you with a religious experience?
Oh, well, I never really wanted to baptize it that way. It was just, it was so extraordinary and so bizarre that I never really had much interest in bringing a religious concept to it. That's what Leary wanted to do. You know, they wanted, and that's why it opened up into Eastern mysticism, which was appropriate for psychedelics, unlike Western Christianity, which is much more rational, self-conscious, and, you know, ego-centered. So that, you know, as a Lutheran, I had a kind of stability that wasn't really shaken that much by taking psychedelics.
I see. And you also had an experience on DMT. Then, and could you tell us about that and how you dealt with it?
Well, that was the most powerful experience in the sense that it's like being smashed. And it lasts just a half an hour, and it is extremely electrical and geometrical, and you get this amazing visual hallucination and so on. So, you know, I did that twice, and that was enough for me because it was such an extraordinary ripping of your consciousness into all this phantasmagoria that you could visualize in space, and that was a really interesting one.
You said something about you felt you were being broiled?
Yeah, but the first moment when it took effect, I thought I was a broiler in an oven, which was such a funny metaphor, and I thought, oh, man, I'm going to fry myself to death. I'm ready to go out, and I thought I was going to die, and I thought Timothy Leary would have to deal with me. And then some kind of voice said, well, why don't you see what it's like to be an electric broiler? And I went, okay. And then everything was fine.
So you changed your attitude and it became a much more bearable
experience. Isn't it odd that you'd get a voice that would tell you how to deal with what you're experiencing when you think you're going to broil out in an oven and your consciousness is just going to actually ignite and explode? And the voice says, why don't you see what it's like? And I thought, okay, why not? I mean, that's such a strange memory that you know, I was kind of protected in my reaction because I thought I was going to die. And instead, it became, you know, one of the most amazing experiences of my life.
So you essentially turned a bad trip into a good trip by...
Yeah.
No
kidding. It's like an inner daemon. Not a demon. You know, there's a Greek notion of a daemon. It's kind of like a guardian angel. And if you have that protecting you and guiding you and instructing you, that's a wonderful thing.
So it's very important when people do engage in these substances to have the correct set and setting. So that
yeah, absolutely. That was Tim's absolute principle, because he knew that if you were in some kind of a threatening context, it was really stupid to imbibe in psychedelic drugs. You had to be prepared for it, and you had to do it in the proper setting, and the setting would have an enormous effect on what kind of experience you enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. And Timothy also did some studies, like with prisoners, and how they after the psychedelic experience, they actually, you know.
Yeah, that was how the whole project started at Harvard. They had Timothy was very much interested in game theory, and he thought people played, you know, various games. That was the lifestyle aspect. And so he gravitated to criminals in a state prison, Walpole State Prison, and he thought by virtue of giving psychedelics, in that case psilocybin, the extract from the mushroom, mm-hmm. that it would provide a life-changing, transformative experience for the prisoners, and they could get out of their criminal game. And they had remarkable success in doing that, but they put so much time in relating to prisoners and seeing them through after they were released from prison that had a lot to do with it.
So there wasn't any controlled study where they put a lot of time into prisoners that hadn't taken psychedelics. So is that correct?
No. It was really just it was a kind of a missionary, mm-hmm. You know, attitude that you could change somebody's life by giving them psilocybin. And then you did everything possible to see them through the change.
So that's something that really never was followed up. There was, you know, there could have been some potential there, but shortly thereafter the laws changed and you psychiatrists couldn't even.
Yeah, that all kind of died out. You know, they were doing lots of work with alcoholics. They thought they could shift alcoholics out of their alcoholism by giving them psychedelics. Prisoners, you know, whatever. It was an enormous tool for that. And then the reaction to any kind of research in that regard set in, and it was snuffed out. And, you know, now it's kind of coming back a little bit. There's this guy named Rick Dobbins who's got a center here in Santa Cruz.
Oh, that's MAPS, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's kind of carried the ball in the next generation after it was pretty much squelched.
Yeah, they're up on Mission. If anybody, well, I did some volunteer work with them recently, and they're
yeah, and he's got a center in the East, and I met him years ago when he first came through, interviewing people who had been involved in the group around Leary, and he's carried it through in a really interesting way.
It's good to see that we're finally, after all these years, some more research is being done on it.
It's so explosive and it's so difficult to control, mm-hmm. that, you know, the research aspect of it is very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Especially under repressive government policies.
All that. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, in a way, the restraints on consciousness are important because, you know, that's how we get along with everyday life. So to have these explosive materials dislodge you to the extent that they do, it's difficult for anybody to handle that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Look at the history of drugs in our culture since the 60s. It's just such an amazing history. You can't compute, you know, what it's all been about.
Well, yeah, it's really hard to get good LSD anymore since Sandoz doesn't make the base lysergic that it's made from. So these days it's, you know, much less potent or mushrooms.
Yeah, and how can you trust any street stuff where you have no idea who's made it and what it's about? That's led to really disastrous results.
And another thing I noticed during the 60s, that after, like in 68, there was quite a bit of revolution going on throughout the country. And very shortly after that, a lot of heroin flooded the area, and very much in the way that the English used opium against China to control it. I mean, you do have to make, you know, you just can't take any drug. There are differences between the drugs, and I think heroin just kind of enslaves people, and I think that's kind of what may have been a CIA program or something.
Yeah, and the destructive consequences are incalculable, mm-hmm. and the heroin problem in Santa Cruz,
yes.
I don't think anybody's really been able to understand.
Well, no. Well, the police are all busy harassing the homeless instead of being arrested.
Yeah, exactly.
Which brings up another thing. You've done quite a bit for the homeless around Santa Cruz, haven't you?
Yeah, I started the whole show. Paige Smith and I. We responded to Jane Immler when she went on a fast of the deaf. until somebody opened a homeless shelter, and Paige and I responded to her call, and we got her off her fast just as about the time she was going to die. That was at Christmas time in 1985. And so we had the first public shelter, and then we did the church program where we organized up to 40 churches to take in homeless. That's over with now. Then we started the Homeless Garden Project. Then we did Paige Smith Community House. Now they got the Paul Lee Loft. So that's been a wonderful experience.
Yeah, that's really great.
Nui, thank you. This is Coral Reef. About you, hey. Robert.
You're Robert most welcome.
How you doing, Paul?
Fine.
You started the Homeless Garden Project. What year was that?
1989. They're mistaken about it being the anniversary this year when it actually started in 1989, not 1990. So who cares? Anyhow, that's when we got it started. I got the offer of a huge amount of herbal plants from some herbal nursery that was closing down. So I figured, okay, if I get the plants, I'll have to start a garden. And I wanted something to do to employ the homeless that we were taking care of in the shelter. And so that's how it got started.
Can you camp out there?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I'll buy you a tent.
Okay, thanks.
I
got one.
He has a teepee.
I was thinking of something along the San Lorenzo River. There's a lot of land out there, but they've been mowing it lately. But the last 2 years they've cut down every speck of brush.
Yeah, I know it. The big disappointment of my life is the fact that we can't start a campground in Santa Cruz. And that's thanks to Robert Norris.
Oh, really?
Thanks to Robert Norris.
The fact he's identified with it means it's not going to happen.
I see.
Well, if we could just get Robert Norris to back off.
Well, I did storm out of his meeting the other day, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, of course. He's the agent provocateur. He's pissed off everybody, and he's identified with a campground. It's never going to happen. It's the most logical solution to the problem. Here we are 25 years later, and we've solved maybe 8 to 10% of the problem of homelessness in Santa Cruz. And you need a campground to accommodate all the people that are looking for a warm, dry place to sleep.
Did you hear the proposal I made to the council?
No, I didn't.
I suggested that they issue permits, and if you don't renew it every week, then you lose it for 6 months. Plus you got to move every week as near as possible to 100 yards. What I was thinking of was if you didn't for some reason think it was healthy to live in a large square block style architectural dwelling, you could live in a tent on your own front yard. And maybe you could have a couple of neighbors, and you could swap front yards every now and then to keep it interesting.
See, but the law reads that you can't sleep in your own front yard.
That's right. That's exactly
what.
That's
so sick, I can't bear it. So I've got Ed Fry, the local lawyer, going up against the camping ban, and I'm hoping that we can overturn it.
Oh, amen. Amen. I was just down at city council today making a counter proposal. I don't know how much interest
I was able to
generate.
We probably need to do sleep-ins, where people simply put up tents in public spaces and then just challenge the authorities accordingly.
You're such a radical, Paul.
Oh, man, come on. I mean, people need a warm, dry place to sleep.
That's right.
What's radical about that?
Nothing at all. I think people have deserve a right to occupy the land. Yeah.
I'll go down and sleep with him.
I'm wondering.
So we can try that. Where would you suggest?
Well, Robert's already gotten two tickets for that. How much is
Robert,
that anyways?
That's what we're going up against. $130 a piece, I believe.
Yeah, but they let you work it off.
Well, yeah.
You know, this guy named Robert, that's a wonderful guy that hangs around Calvary Episcopal Church. He's the guy that we're working with. They arrested him for sleeping near his boat.
This is him. You're talking to him.
That's you, Robert.
That's right. Yeah,
All right.
You're talking
What's your
to
last
him?
Name?
I didn't know.
Facer.
The last name is Facer.
Okay. So you're my guy. I mean, trying to champion you in order to overturn the sleeping ban.
Telling you, that's the best news that anyone could possibly have. I'm wondering why the city council would oppose such a thing. I mean, they want to pay exorbitant amounts of money to sleep every month. I suppose that they all own their own houses.
They're idiot Philistines.
Fascism?
Okay.
Maybe they need a good dose of LSD to change their mind.
Slip it to them.
Sure.
That's another. Well, you know, they used to. Talk about, well, you know, putting it in the reservoirs and...
I'm just kidding. So, but it goes back to Mitch Snyder, you know, who started this whole thing nationally. He fasted against Ronald Reagan about opening a homeless shelter in Washington, D.C. Reagan promised to do it. When he became president, he reneged on it. Mitch Snyder fasted on the White House steps for something like 35 days. He was just about to die. And Reagan relented and opened a shelter for Mitch Snyder.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch Snyder was the inspiration for Jane Imler, who went on a fast locally, so we opened a shelter in Santa Cruz. Mitch Snyder came to Santa Cruz, I don't remember when, it was probably about 1988, 89, to see Jane. And I met him. I was riding in a car with him. He turned to me and he said, "How can you live in a city where they make sleeping criminal?" And he screamed it in my face. And I never got over it. So we're still stuck with it in 2010.
And having a blanket is a separate offense.
Yeah, right. So is sucking your thumb.
That's legal still, I think.
There's a new law every day in Santa Cruz.
So it's a tough scene, pal. All you guys, you've done so much with your radio station to promote this cause, so I'm just hoping that Ed Fry can carry it through. We can overturn the sleeping ban. We can open a public camping place where people can come and find a warm, dry place to sleep.
Amen.
Which reminds me, the Homelessness Marathon will be aired on Freak Radio. I think the Tuesday is the 23rd of February, starting at 4 p.m. until the next day, 24-hour marathon.
Okay, terrific. And then what you should do, you should feature the event that's coming up at the Civic Auditorium in March. I'm sorry, I don't know the exact date. Don Lane is one of the sponsors for it. And there's a huge effort. It's going to bring all of the homeless services to the Civic Auditorium, so any homeless person can go through it in a day to find out what's available for them as services.
That's
excellent.
Got a name. I've got the email. I can't
recall. I assume it's free
the
admission.
Alone something. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're trying to recruit people to come and help, because every homeless person that arrives will have a volunteer at their side to lead them through the process.
Excellent.
Okay, we
and
we
you
will
guys
help
could be
that.
You know be hugely helpful in getting volunteers to help with that effort.
Yeah, we'll put
United Way is, you know, it's really being run by United Way.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody that wants to help could call United Way and volunteer to help on that day. It's going to be a magnificent day for the homeless population in Santa Cruz.
What day is this again?
It's in March. Right. And it's about, you know, second or third week of March, and I haven't memorized the date.
And there will be a lot of forums on dental care and
everything. I mean, all the services available will be there on display for people to take part in.
So we can get that announced as the time comes, you know, as a PSA.
Just call Don Lane and he'll give you, or call United Way and they'll give you all the information on it. And they have a website, so you could pick it up from there, too.
Yeah, that'd be an excellent idea.
Okay.
Another closing words do you have, or do you have any more questions, Free?
I think I'm good. We've been talking to Paul Lee, a local resident, a member of the Psychedelics Club at Harvard, and a homeless advocate.
And a fantastic human being. Thank you for all your work, Paul.
No, it's very sweet. So you're most welcome, and it's really been the most gratifying experience of my life to have been involved with the homeless issue in Santa Cruz. And the rewards, I can't, I'm telling you, the quality of mercy is not strained.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Christ taught originally, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is.
Mm-hmm. So how?
It's, you know, once you experience grace, you know how to give it out.
Mm-hmm.
And grace creates the faith that receives it.
Paul, I you know, I heard you yell something, but I couldn't interpret what it was that you what you yelled. I heard you, and I but what exactly did you say? And don't
no, it's what Mitch Snyder said. He said, "How can you live in a town that makes sleeping illegal?"
There you go.
A basic human necessity.
Yeah.
You know what?
That's what he yelled at me.
Well, of course, if you're on the city council like Ryan Coonerty, you can just fall asleep there.
Or you can.
But I hope he didn't use a blanket because that is a separate offense.
Some sleep in the library. They put their heads down on the table.
Yeah, I know.
Well, that's true. You can't. I believe it's legal to sleep in the day in San Lorenzo Park.
I'm not sure. I think that's included.
Oh, that's well. I'm,
you know, it's actually illegal.
Oh, really?
I don't think that's exempted.
Well, if it's illegal to sleep anywhere, then they've completely extinguished the right, and it's a First Amendment violation.
What about a nap? I'm not sleeping. I'm taking a nap.
Yes, we're going to have to challenge.
Maybe we can beat them on that.
It's beatable. It's beatable.
Yeah, I hope so.
They beat them in L.A. It just, you know, the whole system's against
the time has come. We've got to do it here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it threatens property rights, too, is the main thing. It isn't just that they want to be mean to the homeless. They just want to preserve the value of their inflated real estate.
So keep pushing, you guys. You guys are terrific.
That's great. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, it's nice to have been with you, and I hope I can do it again.
All right. Have a good
one. Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
This has been Free the Land, a new show.
Hi, this is Freer Freedom for a new show, Free the Land, an underground show within Tangerine Dream Team. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Paul Lee and Robert Facer, and I'd have to like to thank my co-host, Coral Reefer.
And thank you, Free of Freedom.
Coral took a risk the other day when we hijacked the station to put on a special tribute to Thomas Paine. She almost got canned, and I'd also like to thank the collective for not firing her. This is Free the Land.
see.